Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Lawmakers search for a way to make up for a drop in Medicaid funding to schools. Candidates for governor file paperwork spelling out who donated to their campaigns, but who filed digital and therefore searchable documents. And a controversial voting law faces a challenge in court. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. If you have questions or comments, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Ethan DeWitt, State House and politics reporter for the Concord Monitor, and Sarah Gibson, education and Southern New Hampshire reporter for NHPR. Thank you all very much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Hi, Peter.
So let's start off with a conversation about Medicaid funding and the drop-off that some schools are experiencing. Ethan, you've covered this for the Concord Monitor. Lawmakers are looking for a way to make up for this drop in funding. Before we get to their proposed solutions, Ethan, can you spell out what the problem is and how they got to this point?
Yeah, so it's like a really complicated problem to explain, but it's got a really big price tag. So I guess the price tag we should start with is $29 million, which is the amount that schools expect to lose this year because of this change in federal policy. So for years, one key funding source for schools has actually come from Medicaid, and that's because a lot of schools can bill for services for students who are low income that they can then reimburse through the Medicaid program.
So are we talking about medical services to kids?
Well, they can be counseling services. They can be anything from, you know, speech pathology, mental health counseling. There's all kinds of professionals that interact with the school system and that the school kind of is able to get in many cases, large amounts of their budgets, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases, millions of dollars, reimbursed for those services that are provided. The issue that has come up is that those services have for years been carried out by mental health professionals and other health professionals who are licensed through the Department of Education. And this summer, the Trump administration kind of issued guidance that was interpreted as kind of tightening that and making it so that, well, if we're going to pay for Medicaid for these services, then these professionals need to be licensed as medical professionals and not just through the Department of Education. That carries a lot of higher requirements, but it also meant that schools were kind of caught flat-footed. And then there was
because a lot of their providers weren't doubly or adequately certified under these new guidance.
Well, there was a state rule that was in response to that guidance that came out in late August, and that was kind of the trigger. So late August is obviously, you know, with days to go until the start of the school year.
Soon, yeah.
A lot of districts are still finalizing their budgets, and so it was kind of a hammer that dropped down, and the state basically said, you need to get all of your professionals who administer all this in compliance, or else you can't get this money. And so a lot of districts said, well, we only have a few weeks to do this. This would require a huge overhaul for all the people who work here, as well as all of our processes for billing, et cetera. So we were just going to have to write this money off, as in not expect it to come in because this is too sudden of a change.
And so what would be the impact on students if that were to happen?
Well, what's interesting, a lot of these services are legally required. They're you know, services through the ADA that they have to provide, and kind of other longstanding statutes. And so the services have to go on. The question is just whether they get reimbursed for those services. And so a lot of schools were like, we'll figure this out in the future, but for now, we're just going to have to be responsible. We have to write that off our budget sheets. This was a year that the legislature and the governor kind of proudly touted all this extra money that was going to schools, a boost in the funding formula. And $29 million kind of wipes out a big proportion of that if it isn't recovered. Mm-hmm. So right now, the race is to try to get schools back into compliance with this new guideline. And this new administration is warning that if drastic change doesn't happen, And if the state were to continue going on as it has been for years, the entire program could be in jeopardy because the feds could crack down and then we might lose all the money. So there's some pretty weighty questions being asked over how best to proceed.
So, Ethan, I'm trying to understand the politics here. And this is Governor Sununu issues this executive order to help schools try to expedite the process and recoup these costs. And I think the legislature is trying to move on this as well. But if my memory is correct, didn't the Democrats refer to this as a stunt by Governor Sununu? So I'm trying to understand why what are the politics here that it would, if this is simply the Trump administration issued these new clarifications and it's causing a potential shortfall, why kind of the underlying political dynamic here?
Well, it was a two-part process. So there was a July 1st guidance that was issued by the Trump administration, their Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. But there was also the emergency rule that passed in August. Now, the Sununu administration says that rule was necessary. We did it as quickly as possible. School districts and Democrats say this was kind of an overreaction, an overcorrection to these federal rules, and it caused a lot more hardship
by Sununu.
By Sununu, yeah, and that money that has now, as I said, been written off in a lot of cases, is not being billed for, may not be recoverable, and so there's frustration on that side that the executive order that the governor issued last week is. Just sort of making up for what shouldn't have happened in the first place in August.
Right. And I think there's also, at least from some people who understand Medicaid far better than I do, there's a sense that some of what was issued by the federal government was really a rearticulation of existing rules that New Hampshire should have known about for a long time. And so, it could be that schools were not getting the guidance for years from New Hampshire. From the state, as it should have been giving, in order to be in compliance for a long time. And as Ethan was saying, I mean, we're talking about a lot of services that go specifically to students that have IEPs, as well as low-income students. So this whole, big budget boost that we saw schools have, that was actually targeted to the very schools that have high numbers of low-income students that have are addressing challenges that are oftentimes they can address in part through Medicaid reimbursement. So really the targeted schools that were getting tons of money from the state are the very schools that could lose up to $1 million in Medicaid reimbursement.
And that was my sense from looking into this, your point exactly, that this wasn't some big direct change in policy direction by the Trump administration, that it really was more of kind of a clarification or kind of a reemphasis.
Right.
So why were they caught by surprise like this?
And there is some guidance going back to 1997 in some documents that suggest that, yes, it is in order to bill for Medicaid services. They need to be licensed by medical boards. They can't be just licensed by the Department of Education. New Hampshire has this kind of I don't know if it's a proud tradition, but it's definitely a tradition of when it comes to finding innovative, we should say, workarounds for kind of some federal rules, especially when it comes to Medicaid, going for that and then later being kind of rebuked by Washington. Another example of this is the state share of the Medicaid expansion program, which we have for years somehow found a way not to pay with state tax dollar money, even though most other states do that. And that's gotten us in the hot water down in Washington as well. So it's kind of a tradition to try to see how can we maximize the dollars that Washington provides without necessarily looking out for what might happen if Washington says you can't do that.
And what might happen is also serious fines. I mean, the state could be facing significant fines as well as school districts losing money. So, I mean, it is a pretty it's pretty high stakes.
Fines for what exactly?
Fines for allowing school districts to inaccurately request reimbursement and receive that. Providers who were not Medicaid qualified providers, providing those services to a student, then getting reimbursed for that service, the state could actually see fines because of it.
And I should say, when we're looking to the fix, the kind of the template right now is to try to speed up. It's not to kind of try to push back, I guess, against this new guidance, but rather to try to get the professionals who are working in the schools accredited in kind of a rapid fashion. So there's legislation now that has been filed that would allow a lot of these professionals who are licensed by the Department of Education to quickly be licensed by another relevant board. If you were, for instance, a school psychologist, the Board of Psychologists in New Hampshire would very quickly take your credentials and license you for that school. And so that's the bipartisan approach right now to try to get schools into compliance. But the big question mark is, what about all the services that are happening now, that have been happening since August, since the school year started? Are those services going to be reimbursed, or is that just lost money?
Because as far as I understand, right, the additional certification that these professionals would get under this change wouldn't actually enable them to provide different services. It would just be the same services from the same people, but just with a different credential, so that they could be in compliance with this.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. This is The Exchange on NHPR. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. If you've got questions or comments about the week's news, send them to us by email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. I also want to let you know that on Monday, Congressman Chris Pappas will be in the studio, and you can send us your questions for him in advance, whether they be about impeachment, the new trade deal, or anything else you have on your mind you want to ask Congressman Pappas. Send them now. Again, the address is exchange@nhpr.org. I want to ask you about another story that you've been following, Ethan, Sarah. A group of lawmakers is asking the Department of Education in New Hampshire to respond to concerns about $46 million in federal grants to expand public charter schools before deciding if they will accept it. Ethan, Sarah, you're both headed to a hearing that starts at 10 o'clock this morning. Charter schools, of course, been a controversial part of the education funding picture in previous years. Sarah, who's raising concerns this time?
Well, mostly Democrats. And this is, we've seen this more and more, really nationally, as well as in New Hampshire, that there's a kind of partisanship and politicization of charter schools. I will say it's a little different in New Hampshire. We don't have for-profit charter schools. So typically on the national scene, you know, Democrats raise red flags about charter schools that are making money off of students who otherwise would go to public school and not necessarily delivering great results. But here in New Hampshire, we do have what are called public charter schools. They're funded both by the state and to some extent by taxpayer dollars, and then also by a lot of donations.
When you say taxpayer dollars, like local taxpayers?
Yeah, it's a little complicated.
We don't have to get too down in the weeds, but it's a combo of the state and local. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
And largely the state. And so the questions are, you know, there are dozens of them, Peter, and they focus on a couple different areas. One of the areas is all of this money that we're being promised by the federal government, is it actually going to increase the number of charter schools such that a couple years down the road, the state has to actually fund these charter schools and has a big hole in its budget as a result. So basically, what is the cost to the state budget, state education budget, if we are to rapidly and dramatically expand the number of charter schools? And then the other questions revolve more around kind of the health and the sustainability of public schools, traditional public schools, because we are seeing a lot, really quite dramatic enrollment declines. We've seen that for a number of years now, and we will continue to see it. And the concern is that if you're pulling more and more kids out of the traditional public school system, you're basically setting them up for failure. That's the kind of the line from Democrats.
Ethan?
Yeah, so just to expand on the funding thing. So, and again, not to get too much in the weeds, but right now, New Hampshire is kind of at a crossroads when it comes to educational funding, at least from the perspective of Democrats. There's a big commission next year to try to kind of look at how we fund schools, although this has been obviously going on for decades. But that's a little bit of the backdrop of what Democrats are saying. They're saying we're trying to find a way to better fund public schools. And what the concerns that they are likely to raise today is that under the formula as it is now, so tuition for a public school student is about $15,000 a year. About a quarter of that for traditional public schools comes from base adequacy grants, which are kind of usually the football that's tossed around. For charter schools, that's about doubled. So they get just under probably half of that $15,000 coming from the state directly. And the trade-off, though, is that they don't get local property tax dollars. So in a traditional public school, you know, a quarter of that will come from the state, from the state general fund, and then three quarters of that will come from your local property tax.
Again, super in the weeds. I know it's not the most glamorous topic, but actually, money to schools was a huge issue last year in the budget, and it's going to be a huge issue again. So just to clarify, when I say local tax, like local property taxpayers are sometimes paying for aspects of a charter school, it's because the IEP services, so special ed services, are paid for largely by the district, or are supposed to be. And so what that means is that the district where the charter school is located needs to come up with the funds in order to pay to make sure that their students, even if they go to a charter school, are getting proper special ed services.
Yeah, and just to step back for a moment and look at the bigger picture, anytime we have this debate about charter schools in New Hampshire, there are these three big issues that come up. The first is, as I think Sarah mentioned, the issue of a potential of an unfunded mandate down the road. And this is true for any kind of federal program where you get a big bump of money up front and then you set up these new schools, and then in the end you have to pay for them ongoing basis. So unfunded mandates, the issue of local control, this is a mix of state and local funding, but it leans much more heavily on state funding. So there's a concern that will have an impact in terms of the local school districts and funding. And then finally, just that this will be deleterious for public schools. If a lot of kids if enrollments are down and kids are going to charter schools, what does that mean for your regular public school? So every time we have this discussion, those are kind of the three big issues that are circling.
But I think this morning we'll also hear from charter school advocates, as well as charter school students and staff who will be there. I mean, there is the argument from the DOE is, look, charter schools, at least some, are quite successful. There are huge wait lists to go to some of these charter schools. We're going to see more and more of them down the road anyway. Why not get this, hundreds of millions of dollars that could, really help pay $46 million, $10 million this year, that could help pay for something that might be happening anyway. And so there is really, there's interest throughout the state in expanding charter schools in a sense that it's going to happen anyway. Why not take the money?
Right. And that's kind of, again, the backdrop. New Hampshire is one of only three states to get these funds from Washington. And I think this is one of the biggest.
It's the biggest.
It is the biggest.
Yeah.
Okay. $46 million. So the argument you're going to hear today from Republicans is, this is a huge amount of money and there may be some strings attached. But when has there not been strings attached when we take in, large amounts of Medicaid money or grants for opioid funding? There's usually some strings attached. And what you hear from Democrats, it may be $46 million, but there are all kinds of hidden costs that could burden the budget down the line. So it's going to be an interesting face-off.
Well, listeners who are interested in this story, keep in mind the hearing's happening at 10 o'clock this morning, Friday morning, later today at nhpr.org and concordmonitor.com. You'll be able to find updates on this story. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Other stories that NHPR has been following this week, a group of monks at St. Anselm College is suing the college's Board of Trustees over the right to amend the school's bylaws. The Board of Trustees wanted to take that power away from the monks as the school approaches reaccreditation. The monks have held that power since the school was founded 130 years ago. The monks said no, they didn't want to give up that power. They wanted to keep it to ensure that future boards do not attempt to weaken the school's Catholic identity. The two parties are due in court in January. Also, Governor Chris Sununu has named a former district court judge who also worked as a prosecutor and public defender to lead New Hampshire's adult parole board. Jennifer Sargent joined the parole board last month. On January 15th, she'll succeed former House Speaker Donna Sitek as its chair. And a Grafton Superior Court judge has denied Littleton Regional Healthcare's request for an injunction related to the opening of a private urgent care facility in town. Littleton filed the injunction in October against DHHS after its commissioner ruled that there wouldn't be an adverse effect on essential health services to the critical access hospital if a convenient MD urgent care clinic opened less than 3 miles away. Also in the news recently, Sarah Gibson, we want to talk to you about this one. You wrote for NHPR that Dr. Earl Metzler, he was one of the highest paid superintendents in the state, working for SAU 55, which includes Hampstead and Timberlane school districts. He said he was not paid enough for some overtime hours. Sarah, what was his argument?
So his argument is that even though he's an exempt salaried employee, he can earn comp time essentially for working on weekends, for working outside the regular workday, and he had created a practice where they basically if you didn't use that comp time, you didn't say, "Hey, I'm going to take Thursday and Friday off next week because I was working over the weekend," you could actually that accrued in money and you could be paid out. But the thing is that he alleges that he should have been getting 1.5 times his daily rate and that he only got one time the daily rate. And that might seem like a small amount, but this is actually accrued comp time that he's kind of getting a buyout for over many years. He's actually been superintendent at this SAU for a long time. And so we're talking, he's already gotten $90,000 in addition to his quite high salary this year. And would be looking for actually that to be higher since the school board, he alleges, did not pay him properly. And so this is kind of part of a longer story of debates in the school board of whether or not this should even be allowed, whether or not it's legal. But he says, look, this policy has been around for a long time, and these bills that I'm sending you caught you by surprise. But that's kind of because you were sleeping on the job, not because I've been doing anything wrong.
So wait, he'd been keeping a record of this, but the school
Indeed.
Hadn't?
Well, it's unclear. I guess that's where the dispute lies. A lot of surprise when this, at least by some school board members, when they said, hey, what's this, $15,000 here, this $90,000 just this year that we're seeing. And, it turned out that it was because of a policy that had been enacted by the school board years before.
Mm-hmm. And is the school district financially sound enough to pay it if it has to?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, it's certainly $100,000. It was an unexpected cost. And it's not the wealthiest district, so I think certainly some parents who I've spoken to and others who are frustrated with the district to begin with feel like it's an unfair use of taxpayer money. But again, Dr. Metzler says this is the policy you guys got, so I'm going to push until I really get the 1.5 times comp rate that I should have been allowed to begin with.
So what's the next step in the story? A court making the decision?
Or? Yeah. So he filed a lawsuit, and we are actually waiting for the district to respond to it to see what they say. But I know that their attorney is working on it now.
All right. NHPR Sarah Gibson, we know you have to run to that hearing about charter schools. Thank you very much for joining us for this part of the show. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Concord Monitor's Ethan DeWitt and Dean Spiliotis will stay with us for the next part of the program. We're going to be talking a little bit about marijuana legalization. It's been up for debate in various forms in the State House over the past few years. We're going to get caught up on where the debate left off. There's been some movement on it this week as well. You can email your thoughts about this story or any other story that made some movement this week. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello, and we will be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And next Friday on The Exchange, instead of the weekly roundup, it's going to be our end of year roundup. We want to know what stories you think were most important in 2019. Tell us about the story you think made the biggest impact, or maybe it made the biggest impact for you. Tell us why. Our email address, exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Ethan DeWitt, politics and state house reporter for the Concord Monitor. And let's start this part of the program talking about marijuana legalization, which has been in and out of the legislature for years. Ethan, catch us up on where we were at the end of this most recent legislative session with respect to marijuana policy. Where were we?
Sure. So there is a House bill that got traction this year. It's House Bill 481, and this is a really expansive bill that would not only legalize marijuana but also create a taxation scheme, and it would allow it to be sold at retail. And that's important as you kind of follow how this debate goes along, because there are a number of ways to handle marijuana legalization. A lot of states do it differently. This was about as ambitious as you can get in terms of legalizing. The idea was from advocates that we will create a structure where there can be retail sales and those sales can be taxed and regulated. And then that will be a selling point in terms of getting this bill across by showing all the revenue that this can bring in. And that was a big point early on. But as the debate kind of continued on, that part of the bill, the legalization and the retail specifically, became a little bit of an anchor around the bill politically. And more people were kind of voicing concern that this would lead to kind of too widespread proliferation of marijuana, and that it should just be a straight up legalization allowing you to have possession. And so where we're at this last week, the bill has crossed over to the Senate. It's now going to go to the full Senate in January. But a key panel, the Senate Judiciary Committee, took a vote, and it was a unanimous vote to set it aside, put it on the shelf. It's called interim study, not take it up this year because they think it's not ready. And one senator, Harold French, who's long been an advocate for marijuana legalization, notably broke from his previous support of this bill and said, "I don't think New Hampshire is ready for this at this time." Hmm. And it kind of goes back to, how are you going to design the system? I talked to Representative Rennie Cushing, who is...
he's been an advocate for
a long
time. He's
been an advocate, right. And he's long seen as kind of the champion in the House for this. He wrote this bill. This bill was informed by a year-long study commission of stakeholders, including, you know, everyone from the Department of Justice to the banking department to health advocates, et cetera. And he said to me that he thinks that moving forward, the ambitions will be a little smaller. It's likely going to the effort's going to take the form of simple legalization, get rid of the retail, get rid of the taxation. And I should note that Vermont, our neighbor that people frequently look to, does not have retail or taxation. It is simply a possession state, and then they have medical marijuana as well. So that may be where this debate goes.
Yeah, this has been an interesting debate to watch for a long, long time. And I remember here on the roundup when we were discussing whether or not there was going to be medical marijuana in the state, and now we're well into that at this point. The split has traditionally been between the House and the Senate in New Hampshire, although I do think the Senate is starting to change in terms of its overarching opinion on legalization. We really are an island now surrounded by Canada and Maine and Vermont and Massachusetts. And as Ethan pointed out, the big issue here is for these states has been not so much legalization, but how you do it. And, you know, one of the things that supporters have used as kind of a carrot has been this idea of capturing revenue through retail sales. And this would have been a 9% retail tax on the sale. So, that's the issues. I think we're headed that way eventually. But the issue is going to be whether we're going to be a retail state or a state that just allows you personal possession and some level of, a few plants or what have you, some level of cultivation. But I'm not surprised to see this particular approach be put on hold for now.
And there's another aspect to this, which is something that even supporters of legalization have brought up, which is the federal government. There's kind of a question mark over where they're going with this. Under the Obama administration, the Department of Justice had something called the Cole Memo. COLE. And that memo was effectively, marijuana is still a scheduled drug. It's still federally illegal. But as states, more and more states started to kind of lay the groundwork for legalization and start kind of path breaking there, the Obama administration said, we will not, the Federal Department of Justice, prosecute transactions in these states. We will kind of, there'll be a bit of a neutrality for those states. The Trump administration under the first Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, rescinded that memo. And it's unclear where they're going with that, because there are obviously still states that have legalized. But one thing I've heard from advocates, including Senator French, is we need to wait and see what's happening down in Washington, because we don't want to get stick our neck out like other states have and then find that the government cracks down and all kinds of problems come out.
It could also be influenced by who wins the next election. I think, with the exception of maybe Joe Biden, who I think has said that he's concerned that marijuana is a gateway drug, I think in general the other Democratic nominees all support legalization. So if it changes at the federal level, I think you'll see the floodgates open at the state level. I think right now we're up to 10 or 11 states at this point. So we're almost up at a dozen states of legalization. And, you know, there are other considerations, like you read a lot about concerns about having a banking system that can deal with retail revenue, because technically banks don't want to handle money for something that is still technically illegal at the federal level. So it's a complex issue. I think a lot will depend on what happens in the next election in terms of the federal view going forward.
Does what happens at the state level matter either? Because the governor has expressed that he's not in favor of legalizing
absolutely,
marijuana.
Right. Yeah, sure. If the governor says he's going to veto it, and he's been very clear about that, then it really would really need an override in the state legislature.
And I should say that this bill, as another indicator of you know why the Senate can kind of easily push this aside, in the House it did not get overwhelming numbers. That did not get a veto-proof majority in the House, though it did pass the House, go to the Senate. And Sununu has been adamant for the whole year that he's opposed to marijuana legalization. Yeah. He's kind of allied with some health advocates on that front.
Yeah, it passed the House 209 to 147, so that's not really a veto-proof majority.
Right.
Well, let me ask you about a different story that emerged in the past week. And this is one that Governor Sununu tweeted about. It's about highway funding and renumbering the highway exits. He tweeted that he opposes the renumbering of highway exits as the federal government wants to. This is pertaining to the interstate. And he says in his tweet, "I don't know about you, but I love the fact that I grew up as an Exit 3 kid in Salem. Exit numbers are a point of pride for some of us in New Hampshire, and we shouldn't let Washington bureaucrats threaten to take that away." Ethan, what's the deal with this, with the highway exit renumbering?
Well, I have to be honest, as someone who mostly drives in Vermont and New Hampshire, it's not something that I'd noticed, but apparently we are one of just three states that does not number its exits by mileage marker rather than sequence. And so I'm used to, you know, driving up 89 or driving down 93, and you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But a lot of states don't do that, and recently, our Department of Transportation kind of made noises that they were going to change this. And one factor of that was Massachusetts changed. Massachusetts was one of the holdouts, and now there's just three. It's, as I understand, it's just New Hampshire, Vermont, and Delaware do this. Mm-hmm. So everywhere else in the country, there's an exit. It's corresponding to how many miles away from the start of that highway in that state is. And so initially, Sununu's Department of Transportation, again, made noises that they were going to they were considering following Massachusetts' lead here. I think Sununu got word of it and kind of quashed that, whatever that was coming from that department, and came out with a series of tweets that were kind of painting this as Washington overreach and kind of as a local control issue, and everybody knows their own exit. Everybody, you know, fond memories of pulling off at whatever Franconia or.
But there's money at stake, right? I mean, there is some federal money. Yes,
I'm not
much, maybe, because New Hampshire doesn't get as much federal money as other states, but there is some money at stake.
Right. I'm not, to be honest, familiar with that aspect of it, but I do know it's something that...
And the flip side is, I think they're saying it would cost over $1 million to change all the signs, because you would have to do it in one shot. It would be too confusing to do it over time. And this is, I've lived in New Hampshire for decades, and it's not something I ever really gave much thought to, but, you know, I grew up on Long Island, and I was an Exit 62 kid on the LIE, so I was about 62 miles outside of Manhattan. So there are, most other states do it that way, but to be honest, it never occurred to me.
I knew there was a thing in New Jersey, right? Yeah, the joke is, what exit?
Yeah,
right?
You know where you are on the LIE if you grew up on Long Island.
I mean, there could be, more people use their phones to navigate, so sure. Maybe this is less. But back before, when you're navigating off of like a few directions that you wrote on a piece of paper, it was kind of helpful to know that, okay, exit 12, we just passed exit 8, four exits away. It's kind of helpful to be able to count that down.
But there are mile markers on 93 North. If you go up 93 North, you can see what mile marker you're at.
So it's just a kind of interesting debate.
Well, there's another story we should talk about, and that's, Ethan, the union leader recently reported that Governor Sununu designated Waterville Valley, three surrounding communities, opportunity zones. This designation comes with some tax breaks. And, Ethan, Democrats had some questions about this. Why?
Sure. So just to explain what these opportunity zones are.
Sure.
In 2017, there's a big tax cut bill in Washington, you may remember, that had a lot of kind of additional programs. One program was this opportunity zone program. And the idea is let governors choose a quarter of all of the designated low-income census tracts. So a census tract is like a group of population in the country. It's if it's in a big city like Manchester, it would be just a neighborhood. If it's in the North Country, or it could be a cluster of towns. It's usually about 4,000 or 5,000 people. And the what under this new law, governors across the state were allowed to, of all of their low income, the tracts that qualify as low income by the U.S. Census, they can pick a quarter of them, and those districts would be vessels for tax deferred investments from investors, from developers. And so the idea is, if you are a developer and you have capital gains taxes, you can defer that if you put that money into those districts. So essentially, it's a tax incentive to invest in these struggling census tracts, and governors get to choose which they are. So New Hampshire had 105 to choose from. That meant that only 27 could make the cut. 27 of the 105 low-income communities could be eligible for these tax breaks, which would bring in money, ideally, through investment. One of the tracts that did make that cut was the tract that includes Lincoln, Waterville Valley, Thornton, and I believe Livermore. And that has caused some alarm because Governor Chris Sununu was once CEO of Waterville Valley Ski Area, which is kind of the primary economic force in Waterville Valley. And his family members still kind of have a controlling interest in that. So the concern was, if you're giving up tax break incentive to this area and you own a significant commercial enterprise there, is that a benefit? Is that a conflict of interest? And that's sort of one of the things that they've been raising hackles about this week.
Yeah, and James Sununu, his brother, and is on a board of directors of Waterville. You know, their argument is that Waterville Valley, the resort, would not qualify because this is only for new development. You know, the issue here, I think, for Sununu, and you know, obviously the New Hampshire Democratic Party, and Dan Feltis, who's in the state senate and a candidate for governor, or want a right to know here, and this goes back to May of 2018, I think, so it's been a little while. It's just a question of optics. You know, the typical average person may see a headline and they say, oh, it looks like Sununu is self-dealing on Waterville, even if the details of who qualifies maybe mitigate against that a little bit. So, I mean, I think this is really going to have kind of a political flavor to it.
So I did some number crunching on this, and one of the concerns is there are 105 tracks to choose from, right? 105 neighborhoods or towns around. So did they choose the most economically disadvantaged communities of those or not? When I looked at the numbers, there were 45 census tracts that have lower median incomes than Waterville Valley, and they were not chosen. So there were some that had much lower incomes. There were 49 of them that had higher poverty rates than this tract, and they were not chosen as well. But what so the Democrats have raised as an issue, saying, you know, you're not targeting the communities that really do need this investment, but the Sununu administration says, well, we are targeting based on economic viability. So, you know, Waterville Valley is right on I-93. Other areas they've targeted are in the North Country that are kind of near corridors where there might actually be investment that could take advantage of this tax break. And so the Sununu says, we chose this strategically not to benefit Sununu, but to benefit
because of development possibilities. Yeah.
But Democrats are continuing to raise questions.
And listeners, if you just a reminder that you can find links to all of the stories that we are discussing at our website, nhpr.org. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And here are some of the stories that we've been following this week. Eversource says it plans to become carbon neutral by 2030. Eversource Vice President of Sustainability Catherine Finneran says the utility eliminated 95% of their greenhouse gas emissions in recent years after they were required to sell off their fossil fuel-fired power plants. The move won't change the kind of energy that's delivered to customers. Also, the Episcopal Church of New Hampshire is launching a new training program for people interested in becoming priests. Rather than full-time seminary school, the church is establishing a 3-year certificate program for people who feel a call to minister, but aren't able to give up their current jobs or move away from home. And the last day to sign up for a health insurance plan this year offered on healthcare.gov is this Sunday. New Hampshire residents can choose from plans offered by Anthem, Ambetter, and Harvard Pilgrim. After Sunday, people in the individual market won't be able to sign up for a health insurance plan until next year, unless they experience a qualifying life event like getting married or having a baby. Also in the news this week, Governor Chris Sununu and Democratic challengers for governor, State Senator Dan Feltes and Executive Counselor Andrew Walensky, submitted paperwork, reports of fundraising. And let's talk about how they filed these, Ethan, because New Hampshire doesn't require them to file a searchable digital list of these. And Andrew Walensky was the only one who did, correct?
Yeah. So this is it seems like an esoteric issue, but it really does have an impact on how well you can analyze candidates' finances. So New Hampshire has a digital – there's different ways to file your finances, and there are different – there are reporting periods at which you have to say, here are all of the incoming donations that we received in this period. Here are all the expenditures that we made. New Hampshire allows you to file that by paper. And so you can print off a PDF or just a document with very tiny grids and submit that to the Secretary of State's office. And it's just a chart of here's everything. And then they will scan it into the computer and put it online. That's been the way for years now. We also have a digital system that allows you to put in that by hand. To put it into the computer so that it's digitized. So you can do it by paper or you can do it digitally, but we do not require you to do it digitally. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that you get these long pages of reports. Often the font is very tiny. Sometimes it's very hard to read.
And in an age of data journalism, there's a lot more expectation that we should be able to sort this information and analyze it in a way so that we can make sense of not just know who gave, which is important in itself, but also make sense of it and see what that means, what these donors mean.
Sure. So what happens is you get, again, as a voter, you go onto the website, you get a scanned copy of often a very tiny font, huge grid with lots of names that sometimes are hard to read, and you have to kind of scroll up and down and try to piece out what might be important. If these were made digital, you would actually be able to search for specific donors. You'd be able to isolate certain dates. You'd be able to rearrange the data. Let's see the donations by the donation size. Let's see them by date. Yeah. Let's do.
Important. It's important to be able to do that.
It's transparency.
Senator Feltes' campaign has promised to do it, but hasn't yet. Is that
They have submitted on their website their filings, but they have not made them searchable. And New Hampshire doesn't have a law requiring
right.
that.
What about Governor Sununu?
Governor Sununu is not as well.
And so has he committed to doing that at some point?
No, he is not.
Okay. Well, we've got to take a quick break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Still to come, the controversial voting law, SB3, had its day in court. NHPR's Casey McDermott will join us for an update. Your questions or comments on this and other stories are welcome. Send them to exchange@nhpr.org or post your comments on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Today, we're taking a look at the biggest stories of the past couple of weeks. Right now, we're going to look at the court case over the controversial voting law SB3. In the studio with me, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and NHPR's Casey McDermott, investigative and data journalist for NHPR. She's been following SB3 and attending the hearings all week. Casey, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
So the trial over SB3, the voter registration law enacted in 2017, began earlier this month. The League of Women Voters of New Hampshire and the New Hampshire Democratic Party are suing the state over the law, which added new language to voter registration forms and new steps to the registration process that requires people to prove they live in the community where they vote. So, Casey, you've been following this for a very long time. You've been at this trial. So remind us, what did SB3 change about voter registration?
Right. So as you said, it added new language to the voter registration forms. And there's kind of two sets of forms depending on when you register. There's one registration form that is used before the final 30 days leading up to an election. And then there's another voter registration form, a different form that has some different language on it that is used within 30 days of an election and on election day. And the additional language in there really touches on what's at the heart of this law, which is making sure that people who are voting in New Hampshire can prove that they live in the place that they're trying to vote. So that was the stated goal behind this new law. So there's a bunch of language on there that is, frankly, a little bit kind of like legalese, but basically comes down to, like, can you prove that you live here? So people can bring, as they have been asked to do for quite a long time in New Hampshire, evidence in the form of either a lease or sometimes a statement from the college or university that they're attending. There have been mechanisms in place to help students comply with this aspect of the law. There's a long list of documents that would satisfy this requirement on state websites. But the issue in the eyes of the people who are challenging the law is that this creates added burdens on people who are, in some cases, least likely to have the kind of paperwork that would satisfy the requirements of SB 3. And one of the other arguments is that by adding these steps on people who register within 30 days of an election and people who rely on election day registration, that will in particular create problems in communities where a lot of people use election day registration. Those communities tend to be around college campuses and in cities, and those places tend to vote Democratic. So the argument that we heard a lot in court is that this was targeted to kind of create confusion and create issues in Democratic leading communities.
Yeah, there are a couple issues around this. We've been talking about this for a long time. This is a 2017 law, so we're coming up almost on 3 years. And, you know, the issues, as Casey mentioned, this proving that you live where you say you live, and there were questions back when this was being legislated about, you know, who's going to be in charge of looking into that and enforcing that, town clerks, Secretary of State's office, et cetera. And then there was also the issue of the fine that you might pay if you vote when you shouldn't be voting, and that had been stayed at some point as being a potential, you know, it was like a $5,000 or $6,000 fine.
And is it still stayed, Casey?
It is. Yes. So that was a central issue that came up in the hearings this week. Well, no, not necessarily. That's a different law. Yeah. So this is the issue that was kind of central in the hearings over the last week or so, was that the penalties associated with, for example, if you go to register to vote on election day and you fill out the form and you don't have the kind of documents that you need on you, or you can't access them easily, like running to your car or something like that, you can check a box on there saying, I will come back with this proof. If you don't come back with this proof
within 30 days or so?
Well, it depends on where you live. But basically, there's a window there. You could be subject to penalties, civil penalties, criminal penalties.
Yeah, I think it was like a $5,000 or $6,000 fine. And the issue was simply that the concern was that was going to deter people. People know that if they don't do the proper paperwork or they can't produce the info, they're going to be subject to a several thousand dollar fine. That's a disincentive to voting.
Right. And the central question of the last week or so in court was the fact that those penalties have been stayed. So the people challenging the law said that you can't necessarily get an accurate portrait of the impact of the law by looking only at the 2018 elections, because that threat of the penalty wasn't on the table at that time. So we can't get a sense of whether or not it discouraged people. The state, on the other hand, pointed repeatedly to the fact that there's no evidence that anyone was turned away from the polls. And there's no evidence, even the people who stepped up as parties suing over the law, college students, they all were able to register to vote. So the state has taken the position that, look, this is all, you know, overblown, and this is a reasonable step that we have added to improve the kind of administration of our elections.
So you mentioned earlier that those challenging SB 3 say that it creates an undue burden. Is there agreement about whether or not there is a burden, or is there some say this is just not a burden at all? This is a reasonable thing to ask of our voters before they cast a ballot.
Right. So the state, part of their argument is that the state, part of the state's argument in defending the law is that it is in the interest of the state to ensure that people, only eligible people, are participating in its elections. And that's kind of central to determining whether or not this is constitutional. And so the state is, you know, just pointing out over and over and over again that there are a number of steps that we take, you know, to make sure that people are voting in our elections, who are entitled to vote in our elections, and that the, you know, governments have an interest in ensuring that people are voting in the right place. That was something that we heard a lot in the courtroom, was that this isn't just a way to make sure that people aren't committing, you know, alleged wrongful voting, which there is very little evidence, both sides agreed, that that is a serious issue in New Hampshire. But the state did say, A, we have an interest in preventing that from happening, and B, we also have an interest in making sure that if someone shows up at the polls, there's a way to make sure that they're at the right place. So, for example, there's some places, even in college campuses, take SNHU, for example. It straddles the line between Manchester and Hooksett. There are parts of that campus where people who live on campus vote in Hooksett. There are parts of that campus where people in Manchester. And the state brought up that, you know, this is one way to make sure that someone who shows up in the polls is in the right place.
Okay. And just so we're clear, what is the relationship, if any, between SB 3, which we're talking about, and the other voting law that we also talk about quite frequently, HB 1264?
Right. This is something that I hear a lot of confusion about. So the HB 1264 is the one where that issue of the alleged poll tax that Dean was referencing.
Well, registering
that,
your car,
where that comes up a lot. Yeah. So they were both proposed at the same time. It was proposed when Republicans took control of the State House a few years ago. So they were part of a package of bills that were put forward as a way to prevent, you know, so-called voter fraud. Again, there's no evidence that that is a serious issue in New Hampshire, but these were part of kind of a series of measures that were introduced and eventually passed that added steps to verify that people, you know, lived in or had an interest in the communities in New Hampshire where they were voting. So HB 1264 is also tied up in a court case. But that is kind of, you know, I don't want to get into the details too much here. I would refer people to our coverage on nhpr.org for a lot of the finite points of both of these. But basically, what you need to know right now is that nothing will change regarding either SB 3 or HB 1264 before the primary. So those laws are in place. Courts at the state and federal level have declined to weigh in on any kind of changes or interventions between now and February when people head to the polls for that.
So if someone is planning to vote in the primary, what should they be aware of as the date approaches?
So they should definitely check with, you know, resources from the state. The state has issued some guidance on some of these voting laws. Check with their town clerk to make sure that they understand the requirements there. And we have a number of resources on nhpr.org that try to explain the various things that people need to do or would be able to present in order to make sure that they're satisfying the requirements
and
of these laws.
One of the big concerns about HB 1264 is that it may affect college students. And I can speak from the experience at SNHU, but I've talked to people at Dartmouth and elsewhere. You know, the universities are making an effort to kind of keep students apprised of the process, how, you know, where they should register, how they should register, et cetera. So they are actively involved in pushing back against what they see as an attempt to limit the ability of college students to vote where they go to college.
Colleges are marshaling
involved.
Resources.
Yeah, they understand the implications of this. Absolutely.
Okay, but take the takeaway, Casey. Make sure you have your paperwork in order, and best to check early with your polling place.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's you know, there's pretty universal agreement on all sides of this that it benefits everyone, both you, the voter, and your local poll workers who are already very busy on election day, to ask your questions ahead of time so that you can make the experience more smooth for everyone.
Well, again, listeners, remember you can find all those resources, including Casey's coverage of SB 3 and HB 1264 at nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Casey, while we have you here, I want to ask you one question really quickly about the 100th anniversary of the First in the Nation primary, because you've been covering it. So aside from it being the 100th anniversary, what makes it different? Is there anything special about it?
Well, it is. I should say, we just did a story about this. It is not technically the 100th anniversary of the New Hampshire primary. It is the 100th anniversary of New Hampshire's First in the Nation
first
primary.
So it's been a primary for a while.
Exactly.
It's not always first.
And it's
yes.
Totally understandable that people might get that mixed up. I got it mixed up a little bit because you're hearing over and over again for the last several years that there's this big 100th anniversary. because the state has been celebrating the 100th birthday over and over and over again, they're
for
just four different
years,
different birthdays. Exactly. So so just kind of a very quick rundown. 1913 is when the law was passed that created the New Hampshire primary. 1916 was the next election year. So that was the first time that there was a New Hampshire presidential primary in kind of an earlier form. This wasn't, you know, we still weren't at the point where like candidates' names were on the ballot or anything like that. But this was a change from when party bosses picked people. And then 1920 is the first time that New Hampshire was first in the nation to vote.
So here we are, 2020.
52 is the first time that the candidates show up directly on the ballot. So our modern primary really goes back to 52.
Okay, exactly. Well, let's get down in the weeds a little bit before we have to end about the candidates running this time around. Dina, I wanted to ask you this because there's a new poll from WBUR and Mass Inc. Polling Group putting South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg in the lead among likely New Hampshire voters. Buttigieg had 18% to Joe Biden's 17%, so not a huge lead, but it's a lead. And with 2 months before the primary, Dean, I wanted to ask you what you make of that.
Yeah, it's a very fluid situation. It really is. You know, any one of at least four candidates, you mentioned Buttigieg, certainly Biden, Warren, Sanders, all are competitive here in New Hampshire. You know, we had been waiting to see whether Buttigieg was going to get any kind of momentum here. He had been trending up quite dramatically in Iowa. And on the heels of that, he started spending more time in the state here. He did a multi-day bus tour, kind of like the John McCain Straight Talk Express. That has apparently bumped him up significantly. But, you know, people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they have deep bases of support in the state. And Biden is right in the mix, too. So this is one of the more fluid Democratic primaries we've seen in a while.
Well, I spoke with Mass Inc. Polling Group's Steve Cazella about this very poll. You can find that conversation at nhpr.org. One of the takeaways, though, look at a lot of polls, not just one, and there will be more during this primary season. I want to thank Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, for being on the show today. Thanks to you, Dean. Thanks also to NHPR's Casey McDermott, investigative and data reporter for NHPR. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks also to Sarah Gibson of NHPR for being here earlier in the program, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, both of whom are at a charter school meeting right now. Find their reporting on their respective websites later today. That is it for today, but remember, the conversation continues online and at NHPR. PR.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.